let's go ahead and get started. For those of you who are here for the first time, my name is Joe Bach, and I am on the faculty of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And this is my second time here at Holden Village. My wife is a Lutheran. I'm a Catholic. She operates on grace. I operate on guilt. So anyway, we're delighted to be here for our second time. And I'm happy to see all of you here today. It's kind of a relatively small turnout, so that means that we can go at our own pace, and there may be questions as we go along. The subject of today is conflict early warning and early response. And there are a number of different people who are using conflict early warning and early response at a local level, which is a relatively new thing. Historically, there has been, you might have remembered hearing about the State Failure Task Force that Vice President Gore started years ago. The idea was is that let's identify countries that are about ready to go into significant conflict like Rwanda or elsewhere, and then let's try to turn that around through some sort of international intervention. So it was intervention from the outside into countries that are faced with significant conflict. What's happened, and a lot of techniques were developed, and these techniques were really aimed at informing governments, aid agencies, international entities, World Bank, etc., and the UN. And what happened was is that there were a lot of early warnings, but not a lot of early responses, because a lot of that is driven by politics. So until you've got what I call a CNN tidal wave or a BBC tidal wave of media interest about a tragedy, typically the international community is relatively slow in responding, and they find it politically difficult to do that. So what's happened is a lot of these methods have gone into development of what I call micro conflict early warning. And so today I'm going to talk about the use of some of those methods, and I'm going to go through this relatively quickly, and then I'm going to slow down when I get to one that was started in Nairobi, Kenya, following the election, post-election violence there, which was, 2007? Is that right? I believe it was 2007 or 2008. Okay. we've talked about different approaches. We talked about the greed and grievance nexus, where grievances are relatively static indicators, and those, when people feel a grievance, like there's inequality of land distribution, or all of the people of one ethnicity get the jobs, the good jobs, and they rule the people of the other ethnicity, like the Tutsis did in Rwanda, ruling the Hutus. Those are called structural indicators. Those are compared to dynamic indicators. Dynamic indicators are events. They happen quickly. And when events happen, combined with structural indicators, that's where you're developing conflict early warning. The data for assessing the dynamic indicators events are both of conflict and cooperation. And mathematicians have tried to determine kind of the overall aggregate amount of kind of the state of ethnic relations in a society by using formulas both with events of cooperation and events of conflict. And they weight those events. Let's say a political assassination would be more important. It would have a heavier weight on the domain of conflict than, say, harassment at a checkpoint. Thinking of Israel-Palestine. If Yasser Arafat was assassinated, which he wasn't, that would have been more potent for the Palestinians than a Palestinian worker going through a checkpoint and being harassed. Okay? But harassment is on the side of conflict, And so you've got different indicators there on a scale of weight of different weights. And then what people have done is they've developed mathematical formulas to get an overall assessment of kind of where a society is at in terms of cooperation or conflict. These are developed, there are the event, it's called events data. People will read newspaper articles and develop the information. People will, some organizations have field officers, people out in the field, and they're observing certain things, and they enter data, they send it in by the internet or by a phone call or whatever. There are also automated approaches based on some work that was done at Princeton University in what's called natural language parsing, natural language interface. Those of you who are familiar with, well, we all are, unfortunately, when you call a place and they say, you know, if you want to, you know, if you need to check your balance, say yes. If you need to do this, what the software that's being used there, when you say yes, is natural language interface software. It's voice recognition software. So there are automated approaches as well to getting events data. And generally, that's by looking at newspapers electronically and pulling events out of it by using what's called, well, a certain kind of, it's artificial intelligence software. Anyway, I'm just giving you a sense about how this is developed. And I'm gonna go fairly quickly through these. So in a lot of places, remember we talked about earlier in the class, St. Xavier Social Services Society, they formed peace committees. They didn't collect events data. They formed groups of people who would communicate with those of the other ethnicity when there was perceived aggression. If there was a rumor, they would contact them and try to find out the facts. They called it myth busting. Okay? So it was all done by people. Okay? They didn't collect any information. They didn't use computers at all. Whereas in other places, capital city, this is a foundation for coexistence in Sri Lanka, they had field monitors and they collected events data and they entered those into the database and they came out with periodic reports. And the interesting thing is that I found here, it wasn't so much the reports that were useful to the field staff, it was the discipline of collecting the data. And many of them told me when I interviewed them that they were seeing the world in a different way. When they had to look for cooperation as well as conflict, it was kind of disciplining their thinking, disciplining their mind. And they found that to be really useful. Others combined both human coding of events and automated coding. And this is typically the case because in terms of the software for automated coding of information, it's only available in English right now. There's some in Japanese, but very little. The Japanese were the first to come out with artificial intelligence software. LISP is the name of it. Okay, now here's an example of information that I got from people who were researching. Joe Bond is a faculty member at Harvard University. They published an article based on this information. This is just a part of it, but they sent it to me on an Excel spreadsheet. And these are the indicators of conflict. This is from the Horn of Africa, and specifically in Ethiopia, hence ETH, and then this was a specific district of where the violence was at. And there in that part of Africa, there's considerable tension, largely driven by land pressure because of population growth. So you've got agriculturalists, those who want to plant crops or have domesticated animals, or both, and then you've got pastoralists who want to graze animals. And so with land pressure, what you end up with are a lot of conflict.
So yes. Population growth and environmental degradation.
It's both, yeah, that's right. And the degradation is creating more pressure.
Right.
So what these people did, they were looking at pressure was their indication of environmental degradation. And they pulled together rainfall, forage. They had a bunch of indicators for that, and that was the purpose of their statistical analysis. They were looking at environmental indicators on this kind of conflict in Africa. The interesting thing here, and I've got this highlighted in yellow, these are the number of people who were killed in pastoral agricultural violence by month in this part of Ethiopia. This is the number of people who were killed. These are the number of animals that were lost through what's considered pastoral agricultural conflict. This is the number of animals, and these are the number of raids that occurred. In other words, what's happening there right now is people are getting heavily armed, and they just go in and they attack either a group that's together herding their animals or an agricultural settlement. So this is what a database would look like, okay? So I was talking earlier about the database. This is what it would look like. Now, before I get into what you use this for, I just want you to think back to Statistics 101. This is real simple. Remember the bell-shaped curve? One standard deviation, this is above the mean and below the mean, one standard deviation is 68% of all the cases, okay? So here you've got 34% of all of the observations, okay? So if in 1 month there was only one animal that was stolen in a raid, it would be down here on the tail. When there were a lot, you know, kind of the general trend is right in here, okay? So typically what you do is you use this information to issue a warning. And they're calling this, generally speaking, pattern recognition. Okay? So let's just say that, let me just explain real quickly. A moving average is when you, let's say you have a, over a period of time, 1 month, this is the average. Second month, this is the average. Third, this is the average. You add those up, you divide it by three, that's the three-month moving average, okay? If you do that with five, that's a five-month moving average, okay? When, and this is a very simple measure that's used by these people in Philadelphia, the police department, for their crime spike detector, and they're using crime data there. What's that?
In Minneapolis, too, we had cars being taken out of people's driveways.
Okay, so they're keeping track of that.
And they warned us to watch them.
So you, okay.
Lost a lot of night's sleep for that. No.
Well, you know, that's a real good example of two things. One is the value of the warning, but number two, the problem of issuing warnings when nothing's going to happen. You worry people, or you get people alarmed, and that can be a problem. So there are some, you know, some challenges there of when to do that. But in Philadelphia, they send the email messages to the police. And they send it when the three-week moving average of crime goes beyond, compared to the five-week moving average, goes beyond one standard deviation. Okay, that's just kind of a simple formula that they're using to issue warnings. What I'm trying to convey here is that there are people out there who can not only help those dealing with conflict, how to collect data, but also how to use it in useful ways. That's really the important point I want to convey.
How is that?
Well, by being able to issue warnings. Yeah. Now, sometimes it's just through human induction. So you could say, someone was talking yesterday about the violence in Kenya. People knew that if there was election fraud, there was going to be violence. I mean, it was like in the newspaper. So everybody pretty much knew that. Well, you don't need a rocket scientist who knows mathematics to come in and analyze that. As soon as there was the election seemed to be rigged, it was massive violence. So a single event that's very symbolic can trigger, you know, there was consensus building before the precipitating event in that case, and there was no lull before the storm. There was violence right away. Okay? So what's been the critique of this? Well, a lot of these systems have been built, and they really don't have a response mechanism. I told you about that. You've got kind of the the academics and the universities, that kind of thing, who we're going to help the communities respond to violence, but nobody's gone out and really cultivated that. Remember I said yesterday, if you're a person of faith, in my opinion, you need to be responsible for guarding the integrity of your faith, because religion is such a potent force among human beings. It's a cultural universal that everybody feels it's a component of human nature to feel spiritually, to have some spiritual component to a personality. Religion is an organized way of being able to work with that, but it can be abused. It can be abused by any faith tradition. For instance, a lot of people think, I mean, we were talking, Ing, right? We were talking this morning about Buddhism. Who would think that Buddhism, where people talk about, you know, meditation and, you know, karma, etc., who would think that that would become a violent religion? Well, it certainly has in Sri Lanka. You hear about all the violence in Sri Lanka? I mean, a lot of that is driven by ethno-nationalist Buddhism. People who think that it is that the island of Ceylon, Sri Lanka, is a sacred place for Buddhists, the golden kingdom of Buddhism. I've been there. You look in the bookstores, the golden time of Buddhism. You know, these, you know, kind of ideas that we own this island. It's a sacred place. We have an important responsibility to preserve it, not unlike the Israelis in Palestine, or what they call Israel, the world calls Israel. Okay, so other systems didn't really issue warnings. They would just come out with reports. Conflict is going up, conflict is going down. Others thought that, as I said, the field officers that I spoke with in the eastern province of Sri Lanka, they didn't feel that the early warning system was helpful for them at all, because it wasn't issuing warnings. They were determining warnings based on their inductive reasoning. You know, it's kind of like, it's almost like one of those great examples of, can artificial intelligence improve on the human mind? And they were pretty much saying, don't kid yourself, right? In a way, they were saying, don't kid yourself. Okay, and then there were other people that felt like, look, this is just too expensive. I mean, you hire all these field officers. They're really the only ones that do any good. They're the ones who actually come in and intervene when there's tension between, you know, Tamil Muslims and Tamil Hindus, or between Buddhists, Sinhalese people and Tamils, or whatever. They're the only ones that come over here and do anything. So don't spend a lot of money collecting events data and sending it to Colombo, the capital city of Sri Lanka, and coming out with these fancy reports. Hire people in the field. They would argue, go back to what they did in India with St. Xavier's Social Services Society. Build peace committees and leave it at that. Okay, now here's what I want to slow down a little bit, because this is something that all of you could use. Just think about that. This is an early warning system that you could use. It's an open source system, meaning that the software is free and it's constantly under development by others. Have you heard about that, when software is being, it's kind of like Wikipedia. You know how people contribute information to articles on Wikipedia? Well, this is software where programmers are contributing code to improve it. And you can download it. It's free. It was started by a group of journalists in post-election Kenya, a group of journalists in Nairobi that kept getting people calling them saying, oh, there's an irregularity over here. Uh-oh, violence is breaking out over here. You see what I'm saying? And so what they decided to do is that they were going to start tabulating that using Google Earth on the web. And they were going to post that on the internet so that people could keep track of, uh-oh, violence is getting really bad over here in this neighborhood. You might not want to go shopping there today. Right? So what they did is that they started accumulating this information. What the software people have done, though, and this is really fascinating, they've gotten to the point not only to where people can submit a report of, say, an election irregularity or of a violent event, or of a good event, by internet, because they've got like this form that you can fill out on the internet, and then you can submit it. Okay, what's the event? What happened? Who are you? What's your phone number? So we can verify this if we need to. And then click send. Okay, that's kind of basically what it is on the internet. What they've done, and this is incredible, they're sending SMS text messages now. And I don't know, if those of you who have traveled, if you've been to developing countries, particularly ones where there's a lot of conflict, a lot of violence, people have cell phones. I mean, it is like a high priority for them, and you can imagine why. They want to know, is mom okay? We just heard there was a bombing over there in that part of the city. Is mom okay? You see what I mean? So everybody has a cell phone, and cell phones are really inexpensive in developing countries if all you do is send messages. These real brief messages called, what's it called? Simple?
Short message service.
Short message service. Very good.
I'm doing that all the time.
Okay. So what these people have done in Kenya is that they've got people being able to send in with text message, their events data, right? So they've got all this data collected. They post it immediately on Google Earth, and they leave that available to people to keep track of what's going on. Okay? It's been used, first of all, in Kenya. It's been used during the Gaza confrontation with Israel. And it's been used in the Democratic Republic of Congo with all of the violence there, the DRC. There's a huge problem in South Africa right now of violence against non-South Africans, and they're keeping track of that.
Which countries?
Well, a lot of the countries where the economies are, you know, in meltdown mode, like Zimbabwe. Those people are going down to South Africa thinking, wow, at least we can survive there. Yes, Ingrid?
I just read in the paper yesterday that the people were doing that in Iran after this last election, in order to get together out in the street. And that was blocked, though, by the government. They weren't able to follow that way. They had to find other ways.
But right.
So that's obviously possible, too.
Yes, they were doing that very same thing, using Twitter is what they were using on their cell phones. But I think there was some blocking of that at some point by the Iranian government.
Yes.
I'm not sure. So that's one of the fault lines of this type of approach. But it was also used, as I think I may have mentioned, in India this year to track the election and election irregularities that were occurring. Now, this group in India, again, all of these applications, each of these is done by a local group. The people in Nairobi that started it are now just kind of developing the platform, the software platform for others. And anybody anywhere in the world can download it and use it.
Its name is crowdsourcing?
Its name is Ushahidi. So you can go to the web, the internet, and just type in ushahidi.org, and it'll bring everything up.
Everything on that particular collection.
Yes.
And also particular countries?
Well, yeah, it'll also just reports on these, but then it'll take you to these people like it's called Vote India or something like that. It'll take you to their website and to the digital maps of conflict, etc.
You know, your family from Togo, and I wonder if that's included in that.
I don't believe Togo is, but there's no reason that a group in Togo
can't.
The
country to the north is something like that to stop a war between the country to the north of that?
It could be used for that. It's really designed for monitoring violence at a local level. To monitor countries going to war, there's a really good group called the International Crisis Group, and they write reports that are really, really insightful and helpful.
We should get that.
Yeah, we can talk afterwards. So anyway, this application has been done. And this is an example of the codes that they developed. Now think of this. You've got your cell phone, and you're putting in a code. So F-O-R-G is for a forged vote. Someone wants to report that, okay? Inflammatory speech is hate. That's easy to remember, okay? This is a very simple structure for an events database. So what they're doing is that they're putting let's say that a forged vote is purple. Hate is red. So they're color coding events on a digital map using Google Earth. And here's an example of the type of messages that they would send. Remember, when you're sending these kind, you don't have much space to send it. So voter report, this is how people have been told to send it. So word carries around real quickly among people, typically through viral email and that sort of thing. So they learn how to code and how to send it. These are two examples of reports from India during by Vote Report India. And these were on Vote Report India's website. I just pulled them straight from there. So somebody's using liquor and clothes to bribe people. There was violence in this location. Okay. Now here's the problem with this. First of all, you don't know, it isn't like when you have field officers and you know you can trust them, right? You know that they're not going to, you know, kind of cook the numbers. Well, you don't know that with crowdsourced information. But there's a young man he's a PhD student at Tufts University. His name's Patrick Meyer. He's one of my heroes. He's taking this approach, and he's trying to explain to people. He met with a lot of people at the UN who were very interested in how to use this approach, but they kept saying, how do we know if it's accurate? You know, how do we know if the data are accurate? Well, he said, well, you might not know if it's completely accurate, but if you start getting into zone B, where the relevance is going down precipitously, because if you're trying to stop conflict, you better intervene quickly. Remember, we talked earlier in this session about the average is 2.8 days, but the vast majority of this type of conflict breaks out within the first day. I mean, not the vast majority, the largest number of observations from Sri Lanka that I had, first day. So you don't want to wait around too long and get into the zone B where you're going to be too late to do anything. So that's what Patrick Meyer argued about in this UN session. They are developing some mathematical approaches to this as well, in terms of checking the reliability of the data. And an example would be if they found out that someone was unreliable in the past, they almost completely disregard their report of data in the future. So they keep track of all that through this software. I'm sorry if this is too technical, but the reason I'm excited about this for you is that this is the kind of thing that people can literally use in their communities if they want to do it. Yes, Inc?
Question. Uh-huh. Has this crowdsourcing been, have there been finds of misuse? Because it can also lead to people spying on each other,
yes,
trying to get rid of a neighbor that they've always not liked.
Yes.
Reporting on whatever.
Right. Ushahidi is trying to deal with that right now. Although the general philosophy is, and they use this terminology, so I'll just mirror what they say. The bad guys are already using this stuff. We need to make it available to the good guys. That's what they say. So they're aware that it can be abused in exactly the way that you're talking about. And they're just trying to, they are trying to deal with that right now. It's a great question. it's a little bit like child abuse reporting when an upset spouse calls the hotline and gets the former husband or wife in trouble. Here's the biggest problem with this approach. Yes?
Would it be
correct? It's Dan, right?
Dan.
Yeah.
Would it be correct to think that the lull phenomenon
right.
is more usual in areas where the conflict is not as long-standing and that the immediate conflict after precipitating
right.
an event is more linked to places where conflict has been going on for a while?
Well, if I understand question correctly, the argument by Horowitz is that there typically when violence is recurring, the lulls are a lot longer.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
That answers the question,
uh-huh.
but it puzzles me because if we have a history of bumping up against each other,
right.
and getting agitated as a result of that, why wouldn't there be a more immediate reaction to a precipitating event than in an area where, it's just starting up? How did this happen? I mean, why would the lull be more of a factor in that kind of a setting where there's not an immediate set of aggravating incidents and aggravating...
Well, it might be that what happens is that there's really not, I don't think Horowitz said that there was another precipitating event in the recurring violence. It just cycles over time.
Could it also be that people become desensitized? So they don't, or they may already know that the next step is a bad step. So they want to
just pull back for a while?
Yeah, they just don't want to precipitate.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah, he didn't really go into that in much depth. It's a good question. I don't think there's been much research on that at all.
So are you saying a precipitating event is not necessary in an area where there's a long-standing history of violence? It just kind of spikes like a tumor?
Yes, it starts recurring. That's why a lot of people, if you think about violence, think about the residual that it leaves. There's a residual, and you've got to deal with that for years because of the pain that it's caused. So that's why typically, oftentimes violence keeps recurring. That's why people who advocate for nonviolence say, really, you're resolving conflict much more effectively with nonviolence than you are with active nonviolence or nonviolent direct action. Than you are with violence.
In the model that you presented, one of the models you presented, though, that sort of time frame of events.
Right, yeah.
It seemed like precipitating event and then lull and then...
Right. And then violence.
And then violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if it's recurring violence, there's precipitating event, lull, violence, and then lull, violence. A continuation. Doesn't necessarily need to be a precipitating event. They remember it. Or their children remember it. And anyway, the biggest problem with this crowdsourcing approach is that you might get lots of people sending in text messages to report what's going on, but unless somebody's prepared to do anything, you don't have an early response mechanism. I mean, you might be able to, like if there's a central place that's keeping track of all the information, call the police. It just depends on where you live, to try to intervene. In India, oftentimes the police are partisan, so you don't want to call. Okay. We've got 20 minutes left, and I wrote down here that we could have a final. I could test you all on your knowledge.
That's one option.
That's one option.
It's going to be a precipitating event.
Yeah, that would be a precipitating event. The other would be, I think Dan had some really interesting thoughts as it relates to this idea of sacred dissonance. And I'd like to go to that and briefly review the diagram, and then I'd like to have a brief conversation about that. And Dan, I'd really like your involvement on this whole idea of civic infrastructure, civil society. So I'm gonna go down to that. I do have some things I want to close with, but for now I'd like to do this. Okay, I'm gonna do a little bit of final. Who can explain the greed grievance nexus? Jay?
I think a grievance is basically a conflict or an issue that one group has.
Right.
And that can be confounded or exacerbated, or a cause can be because of greed.
Yes, somebody has something to gain from the violence,
right.
Whether it's power, prestige, money,
okay.
Drugs, alcohol, sometimes sex.
Retaliation.
What's that?
Retaliation. Getting back at the people who caused him.
Well, it could be. Yeah, it could be the, you know, revenge. Uh-huh. Somebody has something to gain from it. So grievance is kind of a static thing. Greed is somebody is kind of orchestrating it in the background. Okay? Okay, we talked about these levels. I don't think we need to go over that again. Do we need to go through this again? I'm just going to briefly explain to people who weren't, for the benefit of people who weren't here. Think of it this way. These are the people who are trying to prevent violence. These are the people who are instrumental in promoting it. Black hats, white hats, okay? These are one religion, these are a different religion, and those are a different religion. Think India, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, okay? Here, you have intra-religious dialogue about the meaning of a sacred text, about theological interpretation, about what theologians would call hermeneutic variability. Okay? And you have that among all of these. These people communicate with each other. They help each other perceive aggression. So these moderates over here are perceiving the aggression of these people. They report it then over to the other individual of the other religious identity. So what you have is confrontation and dialogue is intra-religious. It's very important. This is a very important thing. You want to deal with the abuse of religion by people of the same faith, the co-religionists, because they're the ones with theological credibility. They're the ones who aren't the other in the eyes of the people that we're dealing with here. Okay? So that's the meaning of this. And keep in mind that it's not just religious leaders. It also involves civic leaders and political leaders. And in South Africa, the civic/business leaders were the ones who were largely instrumental in the overthrow of apartheid. So you can't lose track of all of those different dimensions in this. So ideally, you would have, you know, three of these for each ethno-religious group, three of these, etc. Okay, I'm sorry to go so fast, but I want to get to sacred dissonance. Okay, we have four different areas here. This is secularism. This is deep faith. Okay? This is intolerance. This is acceptance.
And appreciation.
And appreciation. Okay? So over here, people appreciate the fact that they have Muslims in their midst who pray five times a day because now they're going to start praying more, even though they're not Muslims. Over here, they really can't stand to have Muslims around because they feel like it's threatening their way of life. It's threatening their children's faith. So that's the continuum over here as compared to over here. So the theory of sacred dissonance is this, that what happens is people start out in here and they get to a point of reluctant tolerance, and then they start feeling threatened, and the greed grievance thing kicks in, and you end up moving over here to a position of militant religious nationalism. So we've talked a little bit in this course about rant radio, you know, right-wing, so-called right-wing conservative groups who are on the radio, and they're really being instrumental in cultivating a lot of prejudice, maybe even hatred in this country. To some extent, this arrow ought to come down here also, which is in the secular realm, because it's political as well as religious. Often it's a combination. Okay? So the theory of sacred dissonance is that people feel dissonant in their sense of the sacred, in their inner drive for a spiritual quest. They get to a point where they feel threatened, and through civic religious leadership, political leadership, they end up moving in this direction rather than in this direction. Okay? So they start over here, they're a little reluctant, they're doing tolerating, which doesn't mean accepting. It means to tolerate, right? Tolerating and proselytizing, in other words, the idea that you need to change if you're going to make it to heaven. Okay? They move from there over to a point of interspirituality. Interspirituality, in the example that I think of, and I've used it before, is in a city called Berzeit in the Palestinian territories. The Catholics celebrate Easter with the Orthodox and vice versa, because Easter isn't on the same day for either of them. So they get two Easters a year. The little kids get more Easter eggs. They get more candy. They're happy. Everybody's happy, right? So it's inner spirituality. It's the fact that my staff members in Jerusalem, who most of whom were Orthodox Christians, used to fast with our staff members who are Muslim during Ramadan. They would fast all day with them in solidarity. That's inner spirituality. Okay? It didn't mean that they felt that Christ wasn't the Messiah. They felt completely comfortable and solid in their faith. See, that's the important thing to remember. You have to help people realize you don't have to abandon your core self, your core identity, the core of your culture, of your spirituality, of your religion, in order to partake in interspirituality. What you have to do is decide what's really important for you and really focus on that. And we talked yesterday about something called holy envy, or maybe it was the day before. Holy envy is an idea in theology where what you do is you envy in a holy way those things which are laudable in another faith tradition. I mean, the Muslims get up before the sun comes up. They start praying. You know, I started, when we lived in Jerusalem, we had one of the mosques near us, and so we heard him every morning. Frankly, it was kind of a nuisance. You start using earplugs, I'm sorry to say. I wasn't celebrating diversity on that one, okay? But it did make me feel like at least we can pray one time a day. At least our family can have prayers before we go to bed at night. These people were praying five times a day. I envied their prayerfulness. And the Jews in the Orthodox neighborhood where we used to go to the bakery, feeling like we would get lynched as we walked over to it. We didn't. These were mainly Eastern Orthodox, these were Orthodox Jews from Eastern Europe mainly. They were fine. They were very friendly to us, really. But we used to go over there to go to the bakery. But on Sundays, I mean, don't even think of driving your car over there on the streets. I mean, if you want to get stoned, literally, then go ahead. They kept Sundays holy. It was a Sabbath. Well, I'm sorry, it was Saturday. They kept Saturdays holy. Well, I envy that. I mean, and I tried, you know, it's just like, this is a very small thing. I still try to do this. The business section of the newspaper on Sunday, I don't read it. That's not good for the Sabbath. Our Sabbath is Sunday, there is a Saturday. No business section. So I read the business section on Monday. Okay.
Gotta tell that to my son. He's trying to celebrate Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
And the Jewish, why not do what the Bible says we're supposed to do on these days rather than the way we do it now?
Yeah, no, that's
and
good.
How do we handle it?
That's whole. That's,
and that's just a personal example, but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
right there.
That's holy envy. That's great. That's holy envy. That's part of interspirituality. There, I'm just going to digress here for just a second.
And we have another son-in-law from Togo.
Uh-huh.
And they're fighting the countries to the north that say if you don't join a make it a free country, like democracy or whatever, we're going to be at war.
Yeah.
And
that's not.
His family is the most Christian, wonderful, loving family. They're mostly over here now.
That's militant ideological nationalism. Now, there's one other concept I want you to think about. This is really useful, and I call it holy reverence. I've never seen anybody else use it, but I invented it. Holy reverence, okay? Holy reverence is when you observe the presence of God in people of another faith, and you acknowledge that to them. You wouldn't believe what it means. When I stand up in audiences and there's a Muslim there and I tell them about the servants of God in Peshawar, Pakistan, who protected all of the Hindus and Sikhs during the partition of British India. The first nonviolent army in the world was Muslim. So when I do that, because I revere that, when I tell crowds that and there's a Muslim in the crowd, they always come up to me and say thank you. That's holy reverence.
My son-in-law's here this week, still for a few days. You got to talk to him.
So that's an example of interspirituality, and it's an important way of building bridges with people of other faiths in ways that you don't have to abandon yours. You can see God in them. You can acknowledge it. You can appreciate their spiritual disciplines. You can start using them.
And it's happening in the Christian church over here all the time. We never used to be able to commingle with all the other, you know, the Catholic church.
Right.
Yeah. I figured they hadn't gotten here yet.
I mean, look at me, a Catholic teaching at Holden Village.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great thing.
And if we can do that for countries, man.
Okay, I want to go back here, and I want Dan to help us through this. Dan, I took some notes here, but your idea is that over here, the social capital, I gave an example of the Rotary clubs. Rotary's all over the world, right? It doesn't matter what a person's faith is to join Rotary. So typically, they are a civic network, right? They constitute an organized version of social capital.
A voluntary association.
A voluntary association. Okay. So over here, Dan, what you're saying is that the field of trust, not necessarily the number of people, but their field of trust contracts in this direction substantially. Whereas over here, the sense of or social capital, the field of it, in terms of we believe that you are, we're happy to have, you know, Muslims in our Rotary Club, or you're in a Muslim country, they're happy to have Christians or, you know, Hindus or whatever in their Rotary Club. Social capital expands.
Right.
The field of trust expands. And if those of you who have ever read the book by Putnam, Bowling Alone, apparently Dan tells me Putnam is like the grandfather of social capital.
Yeah, he started the concept. He gave the concept some real visibility in the
90s. Okay. Yeah, he wrote a book about, he called it Bowling Alone because he observed people in bowling alleys bowling by themselves. And he asked, wait a second, don't people have friends anymore?
Yeah, the old bowling clubs.
Yeah, the bowling clubs, there were no bowling clubs. So he came out with this book about social capital called Bowling Alone. I think it's a great title. It's real easy to remember. Okay.
For what purpose?
Well, he's talking about how people in this country, and you know, folks that have been looking at this country back into the pre-colonial days, observed how many voluntary associations there were. You know, civic groups and self-help organizations, and that this country was sort of built on, the culture of this country was built on those sorts of associations. And Putnam talked about that in terms of, he talked about the decline of those associations in our country and how that meant a loss of trust and a loss of a sense of reciprocity and a loss of shared beliefs and mores, and how it led to fragmentation, the loss of social capital, the thing that holds us together as a people.
So you end up over here at this end of the spectrum with rant radio, at least among a segment of our population, rather than over here.
Right.
And again, go ahead, Dan.
Oh, well, the other piece of that, where Putnam didn't go was that, you know, from listening to that, you think, well, the more social capital, the better. I mean,
right.
that's a great thing, great right. commodity. We ought to go out there and manufacture some. But some folks who've done some follow-up work say, well, not necessarily. You know, when you look at social capital contracting in a culture, you know, and the sort of collapse of social capital into a smaller and smaller set of ideas, cultural frameworks, who can we trust, who can we believe in, with whom do we have reciprocity, that can lead to things like rogue states. You've got, you know, a small field of social capital. Might be a lot of people in that field.
Right.
But they all have the same belief structure.
Right.
They all have the same, you know, we don't trust anybody outside
right.
of our framework.
So it really needs to be inter-ethnic.
Inter-spiritual.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, we're out of time here. What I want to do is end up with something. Okay, I want to challenge you to do this. I want you to reflect the light of God in whatever you do, including when groups of people misunderstand each other. The theme of our time here at Holden is these treasures. We hold these treasures. The light of God can't be reflected unless you reflect it. It's like light. So when you're in a situation where there are people in tension, think of some of the things that we talked about this week and try to reflect the light of God. That's what I ask of each and every one of you. And if you ever want to talk with me, send me a message.
Do you have a card?
I do have a card, yeah.
One, two, or three, or four.
So thank you all very much.
To our doorstep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's all of this stuff is just coming right and sitting in your lap, and you've got to, how do I handle this when he wants to sell Beitzavot and then he's getting pork and he take on all these, and he's a Christian young man and
right.
family that believes very clearly, and the other one is how to prevent war in this country.
Right.
And
yeah.
I just I'd like to get some cards.
Okay.
Let them have them and you can deal with them. I have choice.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.